Hello, my name is Lily, and today I will be reading AP News. And our first article is written by Thomas Beaumont, published on May 27th, titled "Paxton Dominates Cornyn in Texas U.S. Senate Runoff, the Latest Sign of Trump's Hold on GOP." Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton won the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate on Tuesday, easily defeating four-term Senator John Cornyn in the latest contest, where President Donald Trump sought to oust an incumbent he saw as insufficiently loyal. Trump endorsed Paxton last week, calling him a true MAGA warrior. Paxton's winning victory in Tuesday's runoff makes Cornyn, who was first elected to the Senate in 2002, the first Republican senator from Texas to lose the party's nomination for re-election. Cheers rang through the ballroom at Paxton's election night party when the race was called, and he took the stage to supporters chanting his name. He quickly gave credit to Trump. Quote, "When everyone in Washington told him to abandon me and abandon the people of Texas, he didn't listen," Paxton said. "President Trump is the leader of our party, and his endorsement is the most powerful force in politics." Cornyn's loss followed primaries this month, where Trump successfully backed challengers to Republican lawmakers who had displeased him in Louisiana, Kentucky, and Indiana, a sign of his enduring influence among primary voters. The candidates that Trump endorsed in those states are expected to easily win against Democratic opponents. However, the president's decision to boost Paxton, who won Tuesday with a sliver of the Republican base who shrugged off his past scandals, may be a bigger gamble in the general election. Democrats are hopeful that their nominee, State Representative James Tallarico, has a rare opportunity to win a statewide race in Texas and help the party retake control of the Senate with Paxton as his opponent. Tuesday's runoffs also decided Democratic U.S. House nominees for districts in Dallas and Houston that overwhelmingly support Democrats and a San Antonio area seat the party wants to flip. "I will be the Democrats' number one target." In Austin on Tuesday night, Cornyn gave a short concession speech tinged with emotion to a room of only reporters. "Tonight we've come up short," Cornyn said, adding that he'd support Paxton in the general election. "I've always supported the Republican ticket, and I intend to do so again." Cornyn said in 2023, as Trump was running to return to the White House, that his time has passed him by, a statement that came back to bite him. He was also an early critic of Trump's plan for a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico, a project he now supports. Cornyn had the backing of Senate GOP leaders, who said he would be the stronger general election candidate against Tallarico, who was also the senator's argument to voters before Tuesday, or which was also. That's not lost on Paxton, who said in his speech that, without a shadow of a doubt, I will be the Democrats' number one target in November. Tallarico's campaign hit back Tuesday night on the social platform X, highlighting what they, and some Republicans, see as Paxton's weakness, including an FBI investigation and impeachment for corruption in which he was later acquitted. The primary was long and costly. Cornyn led Paxton in the March 3rd primary, but failed to win a majority. That was after Cornyn and his supporters waged a months-long advertising campaign, mostly attacking Paxton over ethical and personal questions. The two-term attorney general was acquitted on corruption charges in a 2023 impeachment trial, where allegations of extramarital affairs surfaced. Paxton's wife filed for divorce last year, citing, quote, biblical grounds. It gave Cornyn fodder for an ad campaign that, along with allied groups, spent roughly $109 million between the primary and runoff elections. Immediately after the primary, Trump promised to endorse but didn't act until after early voting began last week. Quote, "Ken Paxton has gone through a lot, in many cases very unfairly, but he is a fighter and knows how to win," Trump wrote in a social media post endorsing him. Retired Dallas-area resident David Jacobson, 70, said Trump's endorsement was a factor in his decision to back Paxton on Tuesday. While Cornyn has the most part been a strong Trump supporter, Jacobson generally thinks most politicians have remained in office too long. Maybe it's time for a change, he said after voting. Linda Williams said she voted for Cornyn, calling him the lesser of two evils. She thought Cornyn had a better chance to beat Tallarico this fall. Because Paxton is a crook, Williams said after voting in Plano outside Dallas. Trump snubbed Cornyn amid retribution campaign. Trump, in his endorsement, poked at Cornyn, saying he was not very supportive of me when times were tough, and that John was very late in backing me. Cornyn said Tuesday on Fox News Radio's The Brian Kilmeade Show that the president's ire was misplaced. He said grifters are, quote, claiming that I am opposed to the president's agenda, and I think that's caused some confusion with the president himself, but I've been supportive. Some GOP strategists have argued that a Paxton nomination would cost millions of dollars more to promote in the fall, when money could be spent defending Republican seats in more competitive states. Democrats need to gain a net of 4 seats to take the majority. Cornyn had the support of Senate GOP leaders. Democrats choose U.S. House nominees. Newly elected Representative Christian Menefee defeated veteran Representative Al Green in Texas's 18th District, dispatching a longtime House incumbent who was one of Trump's most outspoken critics. The Republican-led Texas legislature redrew the district when it approved a new House map last year. The new map led to a runoff between incumbents and marks the end of a dizzying series of elections in the Houston area. Former Representative Colin Allred beat U.S. Representative Julie Johnson in the Dallas area's Area 33rd District's Democratic primary runoff. Johnson was elected to the seat in 2024, the year Allred lost his U.S. Senate challenge to Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Allred was running for Senate again this cycle, but dropped his bid and instead sought a return to the House. Near San Antonio, Johnny Garcia won the Democratic primary for Texas's 35th district against Maureen Galindo, a candidate who has expressed anti-Semitic views. While Texas lawmakers redrew the district to help Republicans, Democrats view it as within reach and didn't want Galindo's past comments to impede them. Garcia will face Republican Carlos de la Cruz, who defeated John Lujan in the GOP primary. This next article is written by Russ Bynum, published on May 26th, titled "Woman Fired by Indiana University Over Charlie Kirk Post to Receive $225,000 in legal settlement." A woman fired by an Indiana university over her Facebook post criticizing conservative activist Charlie Kirk after he was killed will receive $225,000 to settle a lawsuit that accused her former employer of violating her free speech rights, the woman's attorneys said Tuesday. The American Civil Liberties Union announced the settlement in a federal lawsuit it filed last year on behalf of Suzanne Swierk against Ball State University President Jeffrey Mearns. Swierk worked as Director of Health Promotion and Advocacy at Ball State's campus in Muncie, Indiana, before she was fired last September. Ball State cited Swierk's private Facebook post about Kirk as the sole reason for her termination, saying it caused, quote, significant disruption to campus. Swierk's firing violated her constitutional rights because she was, quote, speaking as a private citizen on a matter of public concern, said Stevie Pachter, an ACLU attorney in Indiana. Quote, the First Amendment does not allow government institutions to retaliate to those circumstances, and this settlement reflects that, Pachter said in a statement. Mearns defended firing Swierk in a statement sent Tuesday to campus leaders, which a Ball State spokesperson shared with the Associated Press. Mearns said backlash over Swierk's post threatened to cause the school's student enrollment, or threatened to harm the school's student enrollment and fundraising. He said the settlement's modest monetary payment to Swirk was substantially less than fighting her lawsuit would have cost. Kirk, founder of the conservative organization Turning Point USA, was killed by a gunman September 10th on the campus of a Utah university. Before his death, Kirk was credited with galvanizing the conservative youth vote to help President Donald Trump win a second term. Others fired for Kirk posts have won six-figure settlements. Swirk was among a wave of workers who lost their jobs in both the public and private sector after posting social media comments and memes about Kirk's assassination, and she isn't the first to win a legal settlement in court. Earlier this month, a Florida state agency agreed to pay $485,000 to settle a lawsuit by a former state biologist who was fired after she reposted a meme that claimed Kirk wouldn't care about children being shot in school. In January, Austin Peay State University in Tennessee reinstated a professor and paid him a $500,000 settlement after he sued over his firing for posting a 2023 news headline that read, quote, "Charlie Kirk says gun deaths unfortunately worth it to keep Second Amendment." Lawsuits by other fired workers are still pending. Ball State says employee's post led to a flood of outrage. In her Facebook post, Swirk referred to Kirk's killing as a, quote, "tragedy," but she also called it a, quote, "reflection of the violence, fear, and hatred he sowed." She wrote, quote, "If you think Charlie Kirk was a wonderful person, we can't be friends." Swirk's attorney said her Facebook page's privacy settings walled off her posts from the general public, but someone took a screenshot of her comments on Kirk that was shared widely online. Ball State's president said Swirk's post resulted in a flood of outraged phone calls and emails to the university. Some warned they would withhold donations, and at least one parent said she planned to withdraw her children from the school. Some callers threatened violence, Mearns said. Quote, "The reaction was extraordinarily damaging to our university's reputation and image, and it was exceptionally disruptive to our mission and our people," Mearns said in his statement. This next article is written by Colin Binkley, published on May 26th, titled, "Trump wraps up three-hour medical visit to Walter Reed and declares everything checked out perfectly." President Donald Trump had another medical exam on Tuesday, putting his health under renewed public scrutiny after he has worked to dismiss concerns over his age and stamina. The 79-year-old president spent more than 3 hours at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center for what the White House described as preventive medical and dental checkups. It was Trump's fourth publicly disclosed medical exam since he returned to office for a second term, and it comes as he tries to project strength ahead of midterm elections that will test his sway with voters. In a social media post after the visit, Trump said that he had just finished his six-month physical and that, quote, "everything checked out perfectly." The White House did not immediately release a written report from Trump's doctors. For decades, administrations have released selected results from presidential physicals, offering the public a glimpse at the commander-in-chief's health. But the results are filtered through the White House and must be approved by the president, raising questions about what the public does and doesn't get to see. Trump, a Republican, turns 80 next month and was the oldest person elected U.S. president. His immediate predecessor, President Joe Biden, a Democrat, was 82 when he left office, dropping out of the 2024 presidential race because of widespread concerns he was too old for the job. A Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll published in April found that less than half of U.S. adults think Trump has the mental sharpness or physical health to serve effectively as president. Quote, "I think concern for the president's physical health is probably at an all-time high, and I think advanced physical age is the number one concern," said Dr. Jeffrey Cullman, who served as a White House physician for more than a decade under Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. For a president of Trump's age, a complete physical would be expected to include advanced heart testing, screening for common cancers, and a cognitive assessment, along with basics like height, weight, and blood pressure, Coleman said. The White House has not disclosed what the visit entailed, but expressed confidence in what it will show. Quote, President Trump is the sharpest and most accessible president in American history who is working nonstop to solve problems and deliver on his promises, and he remains in excellent health, White House spokesperson Davis Ingles said in a statement. No law requiring presidents to disclose their medical records. In the weeks leading up to his visit, Trump has been saying he feels as good as he did 5 decades ago, even as he jokes about his fondness for fast food and his minimal exercise regimen. Yet he's also sensitive to perceptions about his age, noting that he takes extra caution descending the steps from Air Force One to avoid headlines about a stumble. There is no law requiring presidents to publicize their health records, and the degree of transparency has varied by administration. Trump's past reports have been criticized for offering scant detail and for providing statistics that some medical experts have viewed with skepticism. At public appearances, Trump is often seen wearing makeup to conceal bruising on his hands, which the White House attributes to handshaking and regular aspirin use. He has sometimes appeared drowsy during meetings and closed his eyes for long stretches, though he denies having fallen asleep. Trump often boasts of having aced cognitive tests, while frequently deriding Biden, who faced questions about his mental acuity. Biden and his aides pushed back aggressively against doubts raised about his fitness for office. Some of Trump's previous physicals have included the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, used to screen for dementia and cognitive impairment. Trump's physicians reported a score of 30 out of 30 for him at his 2018 and 2025 checkups. Yet critics have pointed to Trump's meandering speeches and sometimes a bellicose rhetoric as evidence of cognitive decline. Last month, a statement from more than 30 neurologists, psychiatrists, and other medical experts, who acknowledged they've never examined him, said Trump was mentally unfit to serve and warned of an increasingly dangerous decline in his behavior based on what they called objectively observable signs of serious medical concern. Quote, any so-called medical professionals engaging in armchair diagnosis or false speculation for political services are clearly breaking the Hippocratic Oath they've sworn to, Ingles said. Just like any other patient, presidents get to choose what's disclosed about their health, said Sarah Rosenthal, a bioethicist at the University of Kentucky who studies presidential health. Questions about transparency have become more acute as America elects aging presidents like Trump and Biden, she said. I think we can expect very little disclosure about the true health status of any president unless they're in perfect health, said Rosenthal, who has suggested an independent medical organization to review and report on the health of the president and those in the line of succession. Nothing should be hidden. Trump's first medical report in his second term was released last April. In July, he was diagnosed with chronic venous insufficiency, a common condition in older adults that causes blood to pool up in veins. Photographs have shown the president with swollen feet, ankles, and calves, described by the White House as a symptom of chronic venous insufficiency, leading to mild swelling in his lower legs. Following the last publicly disclosed exam, described as a routine follow-up last October, Trump's physician issued a one-page summary saying the president was in exceptional health without divulging many specific results. The frequency of Trump's medical checkups is not uncommon for someone his age, according to S.J. Olshansky of the University of Illinois Chicago, who has studied the health of past presidents. It's part of a strategy to catch problems while they're still treatable, Olshansky said. Olshansky says the public deserves to see more than the White House medical summaries that may be subject to editorial discretion. full, unredacted medical records should be made public, he said. Nothing should be hidden. This next article is written by Rebecca Santana and Gisela Solomon, published on May 27th, titled, Trump's Latest Immigration Move Clouds the Path to Green Cards. When President Donald Trump's administration announced last week that it would require green card seekers to apply from their home countries instead of in the U.S., immigration attorney Flavia Santos-Lloyd's phone began ringing off the hook with clients worried about the implications for them. Lloyd wasn't sure what to tell them, but she knew the confusing new policy would slow down applications. It has a chilling effect because we have some cases that we're going to proceed, and I can tell already we should wait and see what's going on, she said. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services announced Friday that foreigners in the U.S. who want a green card will need to leave and apply in their home country, barring some unspecified exceptions. The announcement, which potentially affects hundreds of thousands of green card applicants a year, was the latest immigration policy unveiled by Trump's Republican administration to stun and confound lawyers, advocates, and immigrants. It's also part of a pivot by the administration to target legal pathways to immigration after focusing since last year mostly on migrants in the U.S. illegally. This is simply an attempt to try to limit and scare people away from the legal immigration process, immigration attorney Charles Cuck said, adding that he expected legal action against the change. This is a scare tactic. As worried immigrants and their employers flood immigration law offices with questions, it's unclear what the effect will be, what exceptions might be allowed, and how the policy will play out on the ground. Some green card seekers were already facing questions about why they should be allowed to apply from the U.S. A confusing rollout for the new policy. For more than half a century, foreign nationals with legal status have been able to apply for and complete the process for permanent residence in the United States, including people married to U.S. citizens, holders of work and student visas, and refugees and political asylum seekers, among others. That appeared to change suddenly on Friday when USCIS announced the shift on its website. Quote, from now on, an alien who is in the U.S. temporarily and wants a green card must return to their home country to apply, except in extraordinary circumstances, the agency said. In response to questions by the Associated Press, USCIS said only people who provide an economic benefit or national interest could likely apply from the U.S. It said non-immigrants, such as students or temporary workers, are in the U.S. temporarily and should leave when that time is up. USCIS also issued a more detailed policy memo designed as guidance for its staffers who decide these cases. Immigration experts who were trying to decipher the news said the memo was more nuanced, leading to confusion over what the change actually entailed. One immigration law firm, Boundless Immigration, in a blog post on its website stating its interpretation of the policy, said officers were being instructed to, quote, apply existing discretionary standards more rigorously, but surmise that the policy doesn't completely stop the adjustment of status process for eligible applicants, depending on the category of visa they have. The company cited previous policy memos about citizenship acquisition that had not prompted harsher steps in practice. Immigration firms and advocates left guessing who will be impacted. Chev Dalal Dini, a senior director of government relations at the American Immigration Lawyers Association, said the guidance may be targeting people who overstayed their visas, such as the parent of a U.S. citizen who remained after a visa expired, an employee of a company who transferred to the U.S., or people in the country on visas specific to clergy and other religious workers. It seems like maybe who they're targeting is potentially those whose period of stay lapsed while they were here, she said. Kevin Miner, a partner with the immigration law firm Fragoman, said he expected that people on employment-based visas, like H-1Bs, would be exempt. Known as dual intent, these visas allow people on non-immigrant visas in the U.S. to seek a green card. Those dual intent visas were specifically mentioned in the memo as areas of possible exception. Those probably are cases that will continue to proceed business as usual, and that we won't see a significant impact, said Miner, who said the announcement Friday took people by surprise. Matthew Sorens, the U.S. Director of Church Mobilizations for the World Relief, an organization that helps resettle refugees in the U.S., said language in the memo referring to the cases in which immigrants have to adjust their status in the U.S. gives the organization hope and expectation that the guidance doesn't apply to refugees. Refugees are people who are fleeing their homeland, who meet a specific set of criteria to be admitted to the U.S. after lengthy vetting. They are required to do that green card processing a year after arriving in the U.S. and can't go home because of the risks they'd face there, Sorens said. Trump's administration has slashed the number of refugees admitted into the U.S. this year and limited them to white South Africans. People who enter the country under humanitarian parole, which allows the president to admit people for humanitarian reasons, in which President Joe Biden's Democratic administration expanded dramatically, could also be impacted, Sorens said. Many of those people might have already had family in the U.S., or they married a U.S. citizen, both of which potentially give them pathways to apply for a green card that could now be complicated. All of these nuances make it difficult to provide general legal advice to people, said Dalal Dini. It's going to be a very case-by-case specific thing, she said. Immigrants facing questions about their applications, group says. The American Immigration Lawyers Association and several people in green card interviews under the new guidance faced questions Tuesday that haven't previously been asked of applicants. One person who was applying to get a green card based off their marriage to a U.S. citizen was asked why they applied to adjust their status in the U.S. instead of going back to their home country and applying at the embassy there. They were asked if there were any factors that would prevent them from applying back at their home country and if they still had family there. Another person was asked to file a form demonstrating why they should be allowed to apply from the U.S. and were told evidence should prove they wouldn't be a financial burden or a, quote, public charge on the U.S. and could include their 2025 tax return, a letter from an employer stating their salary, and bank statements. Lloyd, the immigration attorney, said she has sent emails to her corporate and non-corporate clients telling them that she is monitoring the situation and she will reach out to them as soon as she has more guidance and practical applications. She said she thinks the policy will deter some companies from pursuing green cards for their clients. I don't want anybody to panic, she said. My advice to them is wait and see. This next article comes from the health section. It is written by Lauren Neergard and Shelby Lum, titled, An Autoimmune Disease Stole This Man's Memory. Here's How He's Learning to Cope. This was originally published on November 20th, and it was updated today. My year of unraveling is how a despairing Christy Morrill described nightmarish months when his immune system hijacked his brain. What's called autoimmune encephalitis attacks the organs that makes us us, and it can appear out of the blue. Morrill went for a bike ride with friends along the California coast, stopping for lunch, and they noticed nothing wrong. Neither did Morrill until his wife asked how it went, and he'd forgotten. Morrill would get worse before he got better. Unhinged and fighting to see light, he wrote as delusions set in and holes in his memory grew. Of all the ways our immune system can run amok and damage the body instead of protecting it, autoimmune encephalitis is one of the most unfathomable. Seemingly healthy people abruptly spiral with confusion, memory loss, seizures, and even psychosis. But doctors are getting better at identifying it, thanks to discoveries of a growing list of rogue antibodies responsible that, if found in blood and spinal fluid, aid diagnosis. Every year, new culprit antibodies are being uncovered, said Dr. Sam Horn, a neurologist at Mount Sinai Health System in New York, who has cared for patients with multiple forms of this mysterious disease. And while treatment today involves general ways to fight the inflammation, two major clinical trials are underway, aiming for more targeted therapy. Still, it's tricky. Symptoms can be mistaken for psychiatric or other neurologic disorders, delaying proper treatment. Quote, when someone's having new changes in their mental status, they're worsening, and if there's sort of like a bizarre quality to it, that's something that kind of tips our suspicion, Horn said. It's important not to miss a treatable condition. With early diagnosis and care, some patients fully recover. Others, like Maril, recover normal daily functioning, but grapple with some lasting damage. In this case, he lost decades of autobiographical memories. This 72-year-old literature major can still spout facts and figures learned long ago, and he makes new memories every day. But even family photos can't help him recall pivotal moments in his own life. I remember Ulysses is published in Paris in 1922 at Sylvia Beach's bookstore. Why do I remember that, which is of no use to me anymore, and yet I can't remember my son's wedding? Maril wonders. Inflaming the brain. Encephalitis means the brain is inflamed, and symptoms can vary from mild to life-threatening. Infections are a common cause, typically requiring treatment of the underlying virus or bacteria. But when that's ruled out, an autoimmune cause has to be considered, Horn said, especially when symptoms arise suddenly. The umbrella term autoimmune encephalitis covers a group of diseases with weird-sounding names based on the antibody fueling it, such as anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. When they're not new diseases, that one got named in 2007 when Dr. Joseph Dalamieu, or while they're not new diseases, that one got named when Dr. Joseph Dalamieu, then at the University of Pennsylvania, discovered the first culprit antibody, sparking a hunt for more. That anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis tends to strike younger women, and one of the bizarre factors is sometimes it's triggered by an ovarian dermoid cyst. How? That type of cyst has similarities to some brain tissue, Horn explained. The immune system can develop antibodies recognizing certain proteins from the growth. If those antibodies get into the brain, they can mistakenly target NMDA receptors on healthy brain cells, sparking personality and behavior changes that can include hallucinations. Different antibodies create different problems, depending if they mostly hit memory and mood areas in the brain or sensory and movement regions. Altogether, quote, facets of personhood seem to be impaired, Horn said. Therapies include filtering harmful antibodies out of patients' blood, infusing healthy ones, and high-dose steroids to calm inflammation. Stealth attack on the brain. Those cyst-related antibodies stealthily attacked Kiara Alexander in Charlotte, North Carolina, who'd never heard of the brain illness. She brushed off some oddities, a little forgetfulness, zoning out a few minutes, until she found herself in an ambulance because of a seizure. Maybe dehydration, the first hospital concluded. At a second hospital, after a second seizure, the doctor recognized the possible signs, ordering a spinal tap that found the culprit antibodies. As Alexander's treatment began, other symptoms ramped up. She has little clear memory of the month-long hospital stay. Quote, they said I would just wake up screaming. What I could remember, it was like a nightmare, like the devil trying to catch me. Later, Alexander would ask about her 9-year-old daughter and when she could go home, only to forget the answer and ask again. Alexander feels lucky she was diagnosed quickly, and she got the ovarian cyst removed. But it took over a year to fully recover and return to work full-time. What could cause memories to vanish? In San Carlos, California, in early 2020, it was taking months to determine what caused Muriel's sudden memory problem. He remembered facts and spoke eloquently, but was losing recall of personal events, a weird combination that prompted Dr. Michael Cohen, a neurologist at Sutter Health, to send him for more specialized testing. It's very unusual, I mean, extremely unusual, to just complain of a problem with autobiographical memory, Cohen said. One has to think about unusual disorders. Meanwhile, Muriel's wife, Karen, thought she detected subtle seizures, and one finally happened in front of another doctor, helping spur a spinal tap and diagnosis of LGI1 antibody encephalitis. It's a type most common in men over age 50. Those rogue antibodies disrupt how neurons signal each other, and MRI scans showed they targeted a key memory center. By then, Muriel, who'd spent retirement guiding kayak tours, could no longer safely get on the water. He'd quit reading, and as his treatments changed, he'd get agitated with scary delusions. "I lost total mental capacity and fell apart," Muriel describes it. He used haiku to make sense of the incomprehensible, and months into treatment, finally wondered if the meds coursing through me were really dousing the fire, rays of hope. A growing list of culprits. The nonprofit Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance lists about 24 antibodies and counting known to play a role in these brain illnesses so far. Clinical trials, offered at major medical centers around the country, are testing 2 drugs now used for other autoimmune diseases to see if tamping down antibody production can ease encephalitis. More awareness of these diseases is critical, said North Carolina's Alexander, who sought out fellow patients. That's a terrible feeling, feeling like you're alone. As for Muriel, 5 years later, he still grieves decades of lost memories. Family gatherings, a year spent studying in Scotland, the travel with his wife. But he's making new memories with his grandkids, is back outdoors, and leads an AE Alliance support group, using his haiku to illustrate the journey from his unraveling to "the present is what I have, day breaks and sunsets," to finally, "I can sustain hope." I'm re-entering some real time of fun and joy, Muriel said. I wasn't shooting for that. I just wanted to be alive. This next article is written by Jocelyn Gecker, published on May 26th, titled "America's Tech-Filled Classrooms Are Facing a Backlash Against School-Assigned Devices." Just a few years ago, America's public schools were rushing to get every child a laptop. Los Angeles middle school teacher Anna Soffer remembers it well. The idea was that technology is the future, so we need to put tech in every child's hands. Now, the conversation has flipped. After pouring billions of dollars into laptops, tablets, and learning apps, many schools are facing a digital reckoning. Classrooms have become saturated with screens, and a growing number of parents, teachers, and school districts are saying it is time to scale back. "The Chromebook is just a world of distraction," says Soffer, who teaches 6th grade English and history. She favors pen and paper assignments, but is required to use laptops and online apps for certain activities. "Every day I'm battling, who would you rather listen to, Miss Soffer or Minecraft?" The Los Angeles Unified School District, where Soffer teaches, recently became the first major school district to say it will stop giving devices to its youngest students. It is part of a new screen time policy taking effect in the fall across the country's second largest school system. A sweeping resolution passed last month by the Los Angeles School Board requires the district to eliminate devices until second grade, set daily and weekly screen limits for all higher grades, block YouTube on school devices, and ban the use of devices at lunch and recess in elementary and middle school. The district will also audit its education technology contracts, which the teachers' union says amount to $1.6 billion. The Los Angeles crackdown is adding momentum to calls for reform emerging through the country. In many cases, parents lobbied a few years ago for school cell phone bans, which have now become the norm. Realizing phones weren't the only classroom distraction, they pivoted to a new target, school-issued devices. The campaign for change is becoming a public policy issue. At least 14 states have proposed laws to limit screen time in schools, according to Ballotpedia. The federal government issued an advisory last week, warning that excess screen use among youth is becoming a growing public health concern. Parents say school-issued devices undermine screen limits at home. In Los Angeles, concerned parents last year formed a group, Schools Beyond Screens, and pressured the district by speaking out at school board meetings, on social media, and in private talks with administrators. Many are frustrated by trying to curb screen time at home, only to have screens mandated by school. As a mother of three, Katie Pace does everything in her power to limit screens. There is one family iPad and one television at home, no screen time during the week, and no screens allowed in bedrooms. Her eighth-grade daughter, Clementine, does not have a phone. But as soon as Clementine gets on the Wi-Fi-enabled school bus, her day takes a turn for the digital. For the 30-minute ride to school, Clementine watches YouTube videos on her school Chromebook. In Spanish class, assignments are on the app Duolingo, but many students use Google Translate for answers, Clementine said. Often, kids are playing games on their phones, which are supposed to be locked away. In algebra, Clementine writes with her finger on a touchscreen to solve equations. In history, quizzes, tests, and writing assignments are on the computer. Almost all homework is online. Until recently, Clementine would come home and read a book, her mother said, but not anymore. On her daughter's device history, Pace sees she spends hours a day streaming music, making Spotify playlists, and watching makeup tutorials and cat videos on YouTube. It makes me furious, said Pace, a member of Schools Beyond Screens. My daughter went to middle school and was sent home with a screen addiction in her backpack. The pandemic supercharged student access to devices. A push to put a device in every child's hand and close the digital divide started over a decade ago, but it accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic. Overnight, education shifted online in March 2020. Schools raced to get kids the devices they needed to connect to school. When the 2021 to 2022 school year started, 96% of U.S. public schools reported they had given digital devices to students who needed them, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. Many schools switched funding away from textbooks, workbooks, and paper printouts to digital alternatives. Educational technology, or EdTech, exploded into a multi-billion dollar industry. During the pandemic, getting kids devices was a lifeline. Now it's time that we reset, said Nick Melvoin, the LAUSD school board member who drafted the new resolution. Melvoin estimates that few Los Angeles classrooms are using screens effectively in ways that benefit learning. Too often, he said, teachers are replacing instruction with online apps, using screens as a crutch. Some schools are introducing new limits. The challenge, educators say, is that technology has become so entwined with learning, especially for older adults, that unplugging from screens at school is complicated. In the affluent Philadelphia suburb of Lower Merion, parents launched a petition campaign for the right to opt their children out of digital devices during school, citing questions about EdTech's benefits. The district has said that opting out is not possible. If there's really no evidence that it helps, and in fact there's evidence that it's harmful, what are we doing? Test scores are at their lowest point, said Alex Bird Becker, one of the founders of the group PA Unplugged. Other schools are finding that it makes financial sense to stop sending a device home with every child. Fresno Unified School District, the third largest in California, is spending $4 million a year to repair and replace laptops. Partly to cut costs, the district has told its 40,000 elementary school students to return their take-home laptops, and it will shift computer access to in-class only in the fall, spokesperson A.J. Caddo said. The Simi Valley Unified School District, near Los Angeles, stopped sending devices home for its younger students this year, partly because of costly repairs, but also because they were being used for, quote, inappropriate Google searches and video games, according to a memo to parents. The district now stores the devices in carts at school. A group of parents in Arlington, Virginia, gathered on a recent Saturday night to share their children's struggles with screen addictions and other side effects of school-issued devices. Quote, "None of us are Luddites. I know that technology adds value, and I also don't want my son on YouTube all the time," said Luann Oliver, who hosted the group in her living room. Her sixth-grade son struggles to keep track of online assignments and resist the temptation the iPad offers for video games. Quote, "We get reports on websites he's visited. He's visiting a game site in nearly every class." The Arlington Public Schools District has stopped giving iPads out before first grade and is setting new limits in elementary school, but students in 6th to 12th grades will still be required to have school-issued devices. Another mother, Jenny Sullivan, said she has noticed her fourth-grade son capitalizing random letters and not getting corrected because there is so little work on paper. She also worries about social implications. Her sixth grader doesn't want to go to the after-school program because everyone is on their iPad. "I'd rather be home," he tells his mother. After a three-hour gathering, the parents made a plan to approach the school in the fall with a unified request to, quote, "opt out of the technology and opt in to textbooks and paper." 10 years from now, said one of the mothers, Christina Jackson, "I can't imagine us looking back with any other reaction than, how could we have been so naive that we just handed these devices to our kids?" This next article is written by Gerald Imre, published on May 27th, titled, "Why Trump's Allegations That White People Are Being Persecuted in South Africa Have Been Denied." U.S. President Donald Trump has expanded the number of refugee places available for white South Africans, saying there have been, quote, "recent increases in the incitement of racially motivated violence against them by their black-led government and other political parties." It's not clear what incitement Trump was referring to when his administration made the announcement Tuesday of 10,000 additional places for white South Africans in the refugee program this year to raise it to 17,500. In Trump's latest contention that minority white Afrikaners are being persecuted, which the South African government denies. Here's a look at what Trump says is happening to white people in South Africa to justify their resettlement and why his position that they are being persecuted is condemned as baseless. Attack on farmers. Trump laid the foundation for the resettlement of Afrikaners in an executive order last year that said they were victims of racial violence fueled by government actions. Afrikaners are white South Africans descended from mainly Dutch and French settlers who first came to South Africa in the 1600s. The U.S. has cited a small number of home attacks on white farmers as evidence of racial persecution. The South African government and analysts say that that's a distortion of the facts because black farmers and farm workers are also killed and injured in what are largely violent robberies and not racial attacks. It's true that South Africa has a violent crime problem that affects all races, including white farmers. There were more than 23,000 homicides across South Africa from April 1st, 2025 to March 31st, 2026, according to official annual crime statistics, affecting all races, but mostly the poor black majority. In comparison, there were 29 homicides on farms in 2025, according to the Afrikaner lobby group, AfriForum. Farm killings represent about 0.1% of homicides. South African police say black people were also killed in those farm homicides, though they don't typically break rural crimes down as a separate category or by the race of victims. AfriForum, the Afrikaner group at the forefront of raising concerns over rural crimes, also doesn't publish how many black farmers and farm workers were killed, saying it, quote, does not racialize the issue. Anti-white rhetoric. The Trump administration said that a recent increase in incitement to racial violence by the South African government and other politicians led to, quote, an unforeseen emergency refugee situation and, quote, grave humanitarian concerns for Afrikaners. It wasn't clear what he was referring to because there have been no public incitement to violence. There has been no public incitement to violence by the South African government, which is made up of a coalition of 10 political parties, some of which are led by white people. White people, including some with Afrikaner heritage, serve in South Africa's cabinet. Afrikaners are part of South Africa's white minority, which also includes white people with British and other heritage. There are around 4.5 million white people in South Africa's population of 62 million, which is more than 80% black, but also has other minorities with Indian and multiracial heritage. Allegations of an emergency refugee situation for Afrikaners aren't reflected in everyday life in South Africa, where Afrikaners are prominent politicians, business leaders, and sports stars. Their language, Afrikaans, is widely spoken and taught in schools as one of the country's 11 official languages, and Afrikaner monuments and churches stand and are maintained as part of the country's multicultural makeup. The Trump administration has previously focused on one far-left opposition party in South Africa, which has stoked racial tensions by sometimes using a decades-old chant from the era of resistance to the apartheid system of white minority rule, which ended in 1994. The chant has the lyrics, quote, "Kill the Boer," with Boer referring to white farmer, and it has been investigated for hate speech. The South African government hasn't condemned the chant, saying it has a historical place connected to the fight against apartheid and shouldn't be taken literally. Some Afrikaner groups like AfriForum have criticized the government for that stance and called for the chant to be outlawed. The far-left party isn't part of the government and has no power on the national stage. Affirmative action laws. South Africa's affirmative action laws have also been cited by the Trump administration as evidence of anti-white policies. The laws are aimed at advancing opportunities for black people and others who were oppressed during white minority rule. They are also meant to help women and people with disabilities, though how successful they've been is debated. They have become a focus for Trump allies like South African-born billionaire Elon Musk, who has said he was prevented from getting a license for his Starlink satellite internet service in South Africa because he's white. The government says that's a distortion. Starlink can operate in South Africa, though it needs to follow affirmative action regulations in that sector that require previously disadvantaged groups to have a minority stake in any local entities. The South African government says more than 600 American companies currently operate in South Africa and follow affirmative action regulations. Afrikaners' refugee status. The South African government has previously said that Afrikaners are free to leave for the U.S., just as other South Africans have emigrated in search of opportunities in other countries. However, the government says they shouldn't be classified as refugees fleeing persecution. Quote, "The assertion that white Afrikaners, in particular, endure systemic persecution is entirely without foundation," South African Foreign Ministry spokesperson Crispin Fury said in a statement to the Associated Press on Wednesday. Around 6,000 South Africans have moved to the U.S. since the Afrikaner program started last year, according to the U.S. government. Other issues with South Africa. The Trump administration has a larger problem with South Africa's government, especially its stance on the Israel-Palestinian issue. South Africa, a longtime supporter of the Palestinian cause, has accused close ally Israel of genocide in Gaza in a highly emotive case at the United Nations top court. Israel, founded in the aftermath of the Holocaust, has vehemently denied the allegations and countered that the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, was itself a genocidal act. The U.S. has cited South Africa's position on that issue and the country's diplomatic relations with Iran as evidence of anti-American foreign policy, which South Africa denies. And with that, that is about all the time we have left to read articles from the Associated Press News. Once again, most of these articles were published on May 27th, and I thank you so much for listening. Thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.